What a blessing to be able to sit here together like this, our little group. I don't know how you feel about it, but and I don't feel that way continuously, but there's nothing like Sesshin. And realistically, I probably wouldn't have been sitting here this long if it weren't for all of you. So may we continue to support each other like this, to deeply release our karmic hindrances moment by moment, and taste the spacious openness that is our birthright. It's hard work, you know? Ironically, because I feel like it is this this mind that Menzon is talking about is understandably called ordinary mind, but to really appreciate this ordinary mind involves the hard work of willingness, really, like willingness to let go. And when we let go, something else comes to capture our attention and pull us into involvement. Slicing through the layers with great courage and renunciation, devotion, open-heartedness. We could say there's like three sesshins in one, three aspects of one sesshin. We could call the outer sesshin is drawing the boundaries, physical boundaries of, we say, do not leave School Street or the adjacent park except to go home at night. So we have this, we set a retreat. Sesshin is setting kind of spatial boundaries. I notice often in these sesshins for me, I tend to not even go over to the park. I tend to not even leave the grounds at all. And even to, you know, at the end of 5 days, sometimes to even walk 10 feet down School Street is sometimes shocking. Like, oh, there's more than just this like little property here. I think it's so helpful to to have these boundaries, and then the guidelines of sesshin, we try to keep, especially silence. Well, maybe not perfect, but it's a lot more silent than a typical day, wouldn't you say? And I think that's so supportive. It's not just some random old thing that people do for no reason. it really helps to see that the stuff we're creating is our own. And the Bodhisattva precepts and how we take care of each other, all the forms of Sesshin, and it's beautiful. All of you here, and maybe most people of the Sesshin have the experience. So I think that really makes it easier and more supportive to really, we kind of know, there's a feeling, right, that goes with Sesshin creating this kind of space. And we pick up on it. And more and more we deepen it. So the outer boundaries of our conduct and discipline, the inner Sesshin also drawing the boundaries of around the present moment, even more challenging than the outer boundaries, it seems. Just as we don't let ourselves wander out into the rest of Santa Cruz, we try to keep this inner Sesshin of not letting the mind wander out into the past and future. And when it does, we gently take our mind by the hand and say, come back, dear. Come sit down here. You can rest here. It's much more comfortable than out there. Isn't it? That's like the inner Sesshin of gathering the mind, concentration. So if we have the outer discipline and conduct, the inner concentration, then we have the innermost Sesshin of wisdom, of this mirror awareness. Whereas the first two, that outer and inner Sesshin, are about drawing the boundaries and trying to let ourselves be held by these constraints in a way. The innermost Sesshin of perfect wisdom has no boundaries. The innermost nature of mind is this boundarylessness. There's nowhere outside to go. There's nowhere inside, outside, or in between. It's just vast expanse of receptive, open awareness that's been with us from the start, before we even started Sesshin. It was there, but it was so obscured by our going out that we easily lose touch with it. So I think that looking at Sesshin in these three aspects, three different Sesshins, one Sesshin, that all support each other very much. Of course, the innermost Sesshin is the ground of everything, so that that supports all our practice, our ease, and our suffering. Supports all of it. It gives rise to all of samsara and nirvana, the ground of being. The source of mind is still. But to really become intimate with that heart of the practice the outer and the inner zazen, so helpful. I think that's it's no coincidence that such times of retreat have been an essential part of Buddha Dharma since the time of the Buddha and before. Kind of ironic that we need to go to such extremes to put so much aside to just rest in our ordinary mind. But that seems to be the way that this human condition is set up. And it's kind of sweet, actually, that we get to do this kind of thing. If we didn't, then what else would we do? So, as you might recall, everyone was here yesterday, yeah? Nanzan says, now I will explain in detail the way to clarify and rely on this samadhi. Samadhi seems like it's like a practice, but I would also propose that it's the nature of our mind. It's not really a practice. And even in the early teachings, they say samadhi is a not only a meditation practice, but it's a quality of every experience. In the Abhidharma teachings, there's kind of five universal qualities of every experience, even experience of total distraction. There's a quality of samadhi. I always thought that was kind of interesting. So it's almost like a different type of samadhi than a meditative cultivation. But maybe we could hear it like this. If samadhi is a one-pointedness of mind and object, there is actually a one-pointedness of mind and object even when we're totally distracted. It's just we don't recognize or appreciate it. And we could call that, maybe, we could call that our actual nature. So, to clarify and rely on this samadhi is done by simply not clouding the light of yourself. Or another translation. But this is Shohaku Okamura's whole text, but there's one other partial translation in English by David Riggs, who was an old San Francisco Zen Center practitioner, in a book called Zen Classics. And he translates it as, instead of simply not clouding the light of yourself, he says, it's nothing more than not hiding one's own wisdom light. And then, when this light is clear, you follow neither dullness nor distraction. And then the third ancestor said, it's empty, clear, and self-illuminating with no exertion of the mind's power. And the text of the Xinxin Ming goes on to say, describing this, it's empty, clear, and self-illuminating with no exertion of the mind's power. It's beyond thinking, feeling, knowledge, and imagination. These are all of no value in this realm. And I also find it interesting here that beyond thinking here is Hishirio, which is Dogen's classic meditation instruction. We chanted this morning. First you arrange your posture, you get everything all lined up, settle into a steady, immovable sitting position. Think of not thinking. How do you think of not thinking? Non-thinking. This is Hishiryu. Hishiryo. This in itself is the essential art of Zazen. So, yeah, that's almost like I almost feel like the center of that Fukan Zazengi that we chant. So it may be that, well, actually that term comes from a conversation with Yao Shan and a monk. Basically, that is their conversation. What are you doing sitting there? I'm thinking of not thinking. Well, how do you think of not thinking? Non-thinking or beyond thinking. But it's the same phrase, maybe somewhat unusual phrase. Hishirio is from this Song of the Trusting Mind. So it may be that Yao Shan is referring to this kind of heart of the third ancestor's description of the trusting mind. It's empty, clear, and self-illuminating with no exertion of the mind's power. It's beyond thinking, feeling, knowledge, and imagination. In this world of suchness, there is neither self nor other. To come directly into harmony with this reality, just simply say, not to, or non-dual. In this non-duality, nothing is separate, nothing excluded. All wise ones everywhere enter this source. And this source is beyond hurry or delay. This is the Song of the Trusting Mind. Maybe it's just Sashin creates such a sense, but also I think as practice goes on for me, there's a stronger and stronger sense that all these different teachings of the Buddhas and ancestors are always pointing to the same thing. They're not contradictory. I remember feeling, first getting into practice, hearing all these different Dharma teachings, and even making the lists of them and saying, how could these possibly be integrated? They seem so different, and they seem like they're saying different, opposite things. And I think we can find that type of thing, but more and more I feel like at the heart of each Buddha's and ancestors' teaching is the same basic point. And it can be said in so many ways, which is why there's 84,000 teachings. So then Menzong goes on to say, regarding this empty, clear self-illumination, this is the vital point of the practice and realization of this samadhi. All is empty, clear, and self-illuminating means the light of the self shines brightly. No exertion of the mind's power means not to add the illusory mind's discrimination to the reality. When you make mental struggle, the light becomes illusory mind and brightness becomes darkness. If you don't make mental struggle, the darkness itself becomes self-illumination of the light. Not really that it becomes, it's just the darkness dissipates and the light that was always here is revealed. And so on. And he quotes, again, Hung Jir's expression in Zazen Xin, knowing without touching things, illuminating without facing objects. Is another description. Knowing and illuminating, clearly aware, but with no external object, separate. I feel like very ordinary and very subtle. As I've mentioned before, often the way I work with this is just really resting more and more in nowness, in the present. This is like if we're thinking some other time and place, then we are further away from noticing this light that's here. So really, really present, which is the hard work. I think maybe most of the hard work is really like this story about me and my life. Maybe I'll take it up later, but for now, I'm willing to just drop it, let it go. And all the physical pain, it's kind of distracting, and we don't want to veer off from it or deny it, but yet to kind of sit through it until we're so present that the pain is kind of like, it's not the main point of focus. The fullness of the present. And still here, it feels like there's that sense when we're really still, I have this sense, there's this feeling of separation still. There's still a sense of me doing it. So at such a point, which is not all the time, I certainly confess, Sashin is, I don't think it's so realistic that we can always be completely present, right? But if we have enough zazen periods, maybe at some point we find ourselves resting more and more easily. And then from that presence, that somewhat little sense of separation, I thought that's the point where in a very gentle and almost mysterious way, almost like letting the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas take care of this opening, it's more like there's a little sense of restriction even in the present with like, but it might just be that, just but, or it's not there's some confinement, there's some boundary still, so that okay, just release even more deeply and open. I feel like it's really in the sense of, it's not, in my experience, it's not about concentrate even harder. That's actually almost goes the opposite direction at this point. I feel like it's about really releasing and opening without getting distracted into some other time and place. And then there is this boundlessness right there, and that's how I understand the mirror that's now reflecting the present moment. So it's not so much an experience of the present moment, this empty, clear, self-illuminating nature of mind. I wouldn't call it an experience of the present moment. I call it that stepping back even a little further to that which is holding the experience of the present moment. Almost like it's not an experience. This is why it seems so subtle. and we try to get a hold of it or assess it in any way, is another experience. Seems so subtle, and yet there's a sense at the time that that it's always been here, that it always is the case. It's like this mirror that's holding our life, this mind of ease that also like has these qualities of very, very open and like not disturbed by the experiences, actually, and completely fearless, even almost a little bit. It's a little tricky doing sort of like checking oneself in this space, because any kind of checking is a little bit conceptual, but it's like it's the experience is checking on the surface, but it's very much in tune with this background mirror in it. And I find myself checking, like, would it be okay to completely just die right now? Mm-hmm. If my life ended right now, and there's this resounding, yes, I'm totally ready to die, it doesn't matter. Nothing matters at all, except this is like beyond birth and death, actually. And I have this sense that this is what the, if this is something like Buddha nature, that this is what, it's very, very, very like baby little playing with it, you know. There's so much karmic baggage, like that I've come back into, you know. But it's my understanding of like, it's that same light is what develops into like a completely realized Buddha. It doesn't get improved or anything. It's just that it's more and more comes forth, and more our life comes forth from that place. And that all the boundless Buddha qualities of infinite compassion and fearlessness and letting go of everything are naturally already part of it. We have all these Buddha qualities. It's my understanding. It's just that it's this, you know, this is just this baby, little baby playing with it. At the point of total Buddhahood, it's like the little baby is kind of just dissolved into it completely. Or the baby's maybe playing out in front, but it's kind of like, it's the big grandmother who's just like watching the baby play instead of the baby trying to control the grandmother. Something like that. Menzan, whose name means, by the way, the face of the mountain, or facing the mountain. He's facing the mountain of Buddha, or he is the face of the Buddha mountain that's speaking these words. When you practice and learn the reality of Zazen thoroughly, the frozen blockage of illusory mind will naturally melt away. If you think that you have cut off illusory mind, instead of simply clarifying how illusory mind melts, illusory mind will come up again as though you had cut the stem of a blade of grass or the trunk of a tree and left the root alive. This is very natural. Got a sense of this image is that the frozen blockage of illusory mind is not something to cut off or get rid of, like extract and remove, because it's actually just, its nature is actually just water. So it just needs to be melted with the warmth of Buddha awareness. I think I recall in an old Sangha newsletter, late abbot Catherine Tennis quoting that section. Does that sound familiar?
No?
I'll look for it later. I'll see what she says about this or look for it. Yeah, I think actually quoting this text and saying about illusory mind melting as opposed to cutting off like cutting the stem of grass. And I think I've told this story, some of you might have heard. I once met this Korean Zen teacher who was kind of like the classic Zen master, so fierce it was almost terrifying. I was thinking about doing a Korean ordination, so I had arranged to an American Korean temple to meet with this special teacher who was coming from Korea. And I went with the group to the airport to pick him up, and he came off the plane with his okesa on, which is kind of like unusual. Even in Korea, even people, they maybe would wear rakusu, right? But he's like, I'm just doing my thing, you know? He didn't speak any English at all, though. And he comes and he's strutting off the plane, like, you know, walking down the airport aisles and just like total confidence, you know? And this is going to be interesting few days here. So then we went out to dinner. This group brought him to a restaurant, and somebody explained that this is the person that is looking to do this ordination with you. And so he just immediately starts kind of like checking me out and testing me over dinner through a translator. And he's like, you know, what's your meditation practice? What's your zazen? And it was interesting because it was this time when I was really like obsessed about the precepts and ordination, and I had been kind of I was still sitting, but I wasn't putting my attention into zazen mind so much. Oh, zazen? Oh, yeah, this is a Zen thing here. That's right. Because my zazen is like, well, you know, stuff comes up and I just let it go. I mean, that's a valid zazen, yeah? And he said, and then what? And he said, then more stuff comes up and I let it go. And then what? More stuff comes up, let it go. You know, basically delusions and distractions arise, just keep letting them go. They come up and let them go. And over and endlessly is my understanding of zazen. And he said, well, that sounds just like, you know, cutting a blade of grass or even like you might even use the image like putting a big rock down on top of grass. So it's like, it seems like the weeds are not growing and spreading, but underneath they're still growing, and you pull the rock off and they just pop right back up. Or even if you cut it, it goes back up. And bamboo, even if you pull out everything that you can see on the surface, it'll still, the tiny little root down there will still sprout up another whole forest. So I think that's that same image. At which point I was speechless. When he brought that up, I thought, yeah. He's like, how will you know, that's just like endless work over and over. How will you actually be free, you know? Which I think implying that there's some kind of our thinking is off track. My understanding is off. To think that I'm just going to keep doing this letting go thing instead of like, where's the prajnaparamita? Where's the wisdom that sees this whole process is a kind of illusory thing? And what about the effortless samadhi? With no exertion of the mind's power to keep pulling up the grass or keep widening the rock that gets placed on it. And then I said, well, I think I said something like, I kind of saw his point and said, well, please tell me, please help me understand Zazen. And he said, now is not the time or the place. We're at a restaurant and this is like serious business. We're not going to talk about the deepest matter of birth and death right now. And in fact, we're probably not going to talk about it later at the temple. If you really want to get to the bottom of the Zazen, you should come back to Korea with me. Yeah, basically. I mean, over the course of time, that became revealed. And he said, and meanwhile, I'm like, I have a Zen teacher that I really have a very intimate connection with, and I trust deeply. I'm not actually looking for a Zen teacher, but I am looking to receive the precepts, these, you know, monastic precepts, which we don't have in Japanese Zen. This was kind of what it was about. Right? And he said, negligent, basically. It would be, I would feel negligent and, not fulfilling my bodhisattva vow to give you these precepts without giving you the entire Dharma. And I'll give you everything, but you have to come with me. So, I might have thought about it temporarily, but I did not go. And it was a great disappointment. And I did not receive those precepts. And over time, that was many, many years ago, over time, I've come to feel deeply in my heart that our bodhisattva precepts are complete and nothing more is needed in the precept realm. I think we still do need times like Sesshin where we set the boundaries. We maybe have extra guidelines for Sesshin, right? But more and more I see the beauty in Dogen's way of simply plain old ordinary bodhisattva precepts. And this image of the frozen blockage of illusory mind melting away is a great image too, because it's like this spacious, open, non-dual awareness is like flowing water with no boundaries. And it itself freezes into our confusion and our karmic obscurations are made of Buddha nature. Yeah? They're H2O. It's just that they're frozen. So it's a great metaphor, I think, for everything that's blocking us is of the nature of mind, actually. It's just that it's in this frozen state. So we don't have to do it. We don't have to transform its chemical properties. It's already perfectly water. It's just melting the frozen blockage of illusory mind into its fluid state. So if you think you've cut off illusory mind, instead of simply clarifying, one is cutting off thought, even letting go of thought. In this example, that story I just told, it seems like even thinking of letting go of thought could be a type of cutting off, very subtle type of cutting off, as opposed to clarifying, simply clarifying how illusory mind melts. If you think you've cut it off or even let it go, instead of clarifying how the ice actually is water and melts into water, illusory mind will come up again as though you've cut off grass or a tree and left the root alive. So clarifying the root. For this reason, when you practice Buddha Dharma, you must study and clarify the essence of practice, realization of the Buddhas and ancestors under the guidance of a true teacher to whom the Dharma has been properly transmitted. Otherwise, you'll be wasting your time no matter how long or hard you practice. Stern words. You must study and clarify the essence of the practice and realization of the Buddhas and ancestors under the guidance of a true teacher to whom the Dharma has been properly transmitted. Otherwise, you'll be wasting your time no matter how long or hard you practice. So there's something very subtle about Dogen's Zazen, it seems like. And it's very easy to just sit on a cushion and concentrate the mind and miss the point of Dogen Zazen. And it may be that the true understanding of Dogen Zazen is being the transmission of that teaching is being continually deepened. Even my own teacher, long after his so-called Dharma transmission, his way of understanding and teaching has changed over the years I practiced with him. I feel like deeper and more subtle, actually. Even contradicting things. I would sometimes even call him because I'd really be trying to understand what he's saying. But you said in the past, da-da-da-da, and he said, yeah, I did say that. I guess I did say that. But now I actually understand it like this. So I think it's our understanding can keep evolving. Definitely true for me. Even 10 years ago, it's quite different the way I understand Zazen. And I've been sitting Zazen 15 years or something before that. So encouragement, I think, that there's no end. It's not like, oh yeah, I got it. It's just really simple. Just sit here and let go. I mean, yes, and what is it, the relationship between non-dual awareness and dualistic awareness, for example? And we could talk endlessly about how these work and what is the practice about changing something or not changing something. Is it and what is true freedom? And how does the bodhisattva fulfill their vows completely? There's no end to these questions, I think. Now we reach another heart of this essay of Menzan that was the inspiration to bring this up this year. I've appreciated this essay for many years myself and go back to it again and again, but maybe I haven't brought it up in the Zendo. But this is the year to bring it up. Because practice realization beyond thought and no thought can be compared to the function of a mirror. A mirror reflects both beautiful and ugly things without distinguishing them. This is the natural function of a mirror. But the reflection, which may be beautiful or ugly, is not the mirror itself. The reflection is just a shadow of what's in front of the mirror. So this kind of thing probably sounds familiar to a lot of you because we've been talking about the mirror thing for some months now. But this is the point. It's a metaphor, right? But a beautiful metaphor that the reflection on the surface of the mirror, beautiful or ugly or whatever, is not the mirror itself, but it's not separate from it. The reflection is just a shadow of what's in front of the mirror. If you only see the distinction between the good and bad of thoughts and think it's your original mind, it's the same as if you were to grasp the reflection in the mirror and think it to be the mirror itself. This is a mistake. So basically anything we can possibly think of or even experience. Yeah, more definitely conceptual thoughts, but even colors and sounds and any experience is a reflection on the surface of the mirror. And if we were to grasp the reflection in the mirror and think it to be the mirror itself, this is a mistake. This analogy admonishes us not to get caught up in the distraction of thoughts. And yet, if you think that no thought is your real mind and become attached to the condition of no thought, where neither good nor bad arises, it's the same as thinking that where no reflection exists is the mirror itself, and thus becoming attached to the backside of the mirror. Do you follow that?
Almost.
So it's saying, there's reflections in the mirror, and that's not the mirror awareness we're talking about. So then, if we kind of get rid of the reflections, where there's no thought and there's good and bad, all these things are reflected in the mirror. If we eliminate those and there's no thought, no good and bad, no mind, that's like getting attached to the back side of the mirror, which is, you know, I guess a mirror is probably usually made by painting a glass silver, right? So it'd be like, or you look on the back of a mirror, they're often like gray paint, right? So it's like that non-reflective backside, that where nothing's happening. It's true, there's no, all those reflections on of good and bad and red and blue and all that stuff is not happening on the back. It's very still. It's not nearly as dynamic as the front. But he's saying that's, we don't want to actually just get attached to the backside. It's the reflection that doesn't eliminate the good and bad and all the thinking mind. That's very, very intimate with them. The backside of the mirror is not so intimate with all our thinking, right? It just kind of doesn't have any.
And yet the backside makes the front side possible.
Maybe. So now if we try to... In the mirror, it does. In the mirror, it does. So in the analogy, does it? I don't know about that. I would say in the analogy, it's maybe more like the front makes the back possible. Mm-hmm. I think we could say there is a backside of a mirror, a meditation mirror, which would be like you said earlier, some people try... to rid themselves of delusory thoughts in order to reach a pleasant place of no mind. Is that what you're thinking?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Sorry. I was thinking about the wasting of time. Mm-hmm. Business of, not being the teacher, not being in the sound, and not participating in
rural
life.
Yeah. It's so easy, I think, and there are many practitioners around the world who read about Zen in some books and get a little bit of understanding of it and then try to do it on their own. And it's not that there's nothing comes from that. I think one can progress somewhat like that, but... at some point, to reach the full extent of it, it seems like we need understanding
that
Buddha Dharma Sangha. One might argue that, well, aren't there? What if one read like this text is quite subtle, and he's saying it's all here. He's saying it all. What if we just really read and completely understood what he's saying? Maybe, but we might have questions about it, and we need to see how it comes through actual people and we can see that it's not just theoretical too. That's a living, it's a living practice in realization. It's a human thing. There's some people in the Soto Zen world these days who are experimenting with modern technology, including us. We have some meetings here on Skype now, and synthetic Dokusan on Skype. But there's one group that is actually already done quite several of these Skype ordinations. Skype ordinations across different countries. You know, I think if people were close by enough, they'd say, well, come on over. Let's do this live. But, you know, it's literally like on different sides of the world. And they're like, well, we don't want to make the person, you know, pay to come all the way over. And they really want to do this. So they go through the whole ceremony visually. And the teachers claim this is face to face on a computer screen. And so these kind of things happen in the modern world. And but in the Soto Zen Buddhist Association, of which those preceptors are part, they bring this up. And what do you think about this? And as an organization, it seems that most of the organization feels like we don't agree. We don't think it's valid. Because I think it comes to mind because of this point, there's something about living beings being together. And he said, but it's really face to face, so it's kind of almost, it's different than just reading a book, right? There's a face there, but it's not body to body, face to face. And then after the ordination, then you're training through written instructions that we get emailed or whatever in this group. So the training of those new priests is not like body to body, face to face, like together practice. And I think most of the people in this organization feel like we just can't quite. Maybe we're old fogies that we don't understand this modern technology, but we feel in our heart that it's something's missing there. That wasn't our experience of our practice and training. And I tend to agree with them. I'd say if you really want to do something like priest ordination, it's a big enough thing that you can, if you want to do it with that person on the other side of the planet, you can fly there and do it. And if you can't, then maybe you shouldn't do it. That would be my feeling. Or find someone closer. Soto Zen is in almost every country in the world probably now. So, Sangha, live Sangha, precious jewel. If the mirror reflects nothing, it's the same as if it were a piece of stone or tile. The function of the light of the mirror is lost. So it's the problem with the backside of the mirror. It's just like a stone or tile. This reflective, clear, aware quality is gone. It might, and I would say that, maybe I started to go with this thought of that maybe the backside of the mirror comes from the front, and that there are meditation states that are like completely cutting off all, you know, experience in a way, like sensory deprivation, where you, like Buddhist meditations where you shut off all the senses completely internally and shut off the mind completely and like exclude everything in order to be like really sharply focused on the one point. But this is not Zen. Zen is like, again, almost this opposite direction of like all the senses wide open, everything complete, just open expansiveness, but without getting caught up in That's why the mirror metaphor, I think, is so wonderful. It doesn't block any reflections. And why this is called the self receiving its function, samadhi, receptive awareness. It's just nothing's blocked or shut out. Total open, clear radiance, and yet totally empty, meaning like these images are just images. The function of the light of the mirror is lost if it reflects nothing. This analogy admonishes us not to get caught up in the dullness or neutrality of no thought. As you know, neither the reflection nor the backside of the mirror is the essential function of the mirror, which, like that of light, illuminates itself clearly. You must realize that the Buddha's wisdom, like a great perfect mirror, is far beyond the dichotomy of thought and no thought. So, again, this metaphor of like, we're not getting involved in the reflections on the surface of this side of the mirror, and we're not getting involved in the non-reflections, no thought, on this side. The reflections are like thoughts. They're not it, and the backside's not it, but the empty, clear, reflective surface of the mirror is it. Neither thought nor no thought. I think the mirror makes such a beautiful analogy of like this middle way that's not grasping the thoughts, which are the reflections, and not grasping no thought, which is like the backside. For example, when you sit zazen, if your mind does not arise and function, and if you do not see anything, hear anything, or feel any pain or itch, you just stagnate in emptiness. And maybe emptiness is being used in a slightly different way here than true emptiness can include. It's the emptiness of itches and pains, right? But I think it's referring to stagnate in a kind of nothingness, blankness, that kind of emptiness. If you sit in zazen and the mind is so non-functioning that you basically, like we were talking about, all the senses are kind of shutting everything out. You don't feel any pain or itch. You stagnate in this kind of nothingness. On the contrary, if you see or hear something outside and think of it, or feel pain or itch, you just stagnate in the distraction caused by the dichotomy of subject and object. So difficult. So it's not about eliminating pain and itch, or grasping pain and itch as objects of experience outside the mind. Both conditions are limited by delusory thoughts. Therefore, the third ancestor, again, this song of the trusting mind, says, neither follow after objects nor dwell in a vacant emptiness. You must study this point closely and understand this clearly. Just illuminating color, shape, and sound, etc., and not adding any discrimination, is the Buddha's wisdom. That's a nice line to stop with. That's, I think, one of the juicy lines. This a simple statement. Just illuminating color, shape, sound, pain and itch, any experience, illuminating all of that and not adding any discrimination is the Buddha's wisdom, which is kind of what a mirror does. It illuminates and reflects, receives and reflects, and intimately holds with no separation from it all these experiences, but it doesn't get into discriminating or like preferring this one over this one. Buddha's wisdom. So it's hard to know where everybody's at. Sometimes these kind of teachings could seem like, well, maybe it seems, sounds really, really advanced. I'm just trying to like stay on my cushion and not freak out and get through the day. And if so, I don't know if exactly that I apologize, but it's more that I think, because I've have felt that way sometimes too when hearing this kind of thing and like, oh yeah, great, sounds good, I'm not there. And yet, I feel like I don't apologize because hearing these things over and over and over again, even if it feels like this is not about me, at some point it is about me. And I think, and it could be the very next period of Zazen. One never knows, right? So, and maybe it's old-fashioned thinking or something, but I feel like there's blessings, almost like magic, in these words of the ancestors. They're pointing so directly to something so so ordinary and so freeing and so beneficial and so totally possible for any one of us. It's not really far away. The thought that it's far away and impossible is a frozen blockage of illusory mind. So I do have some trust and sense that, like, as hearing over and over again, and we probably all have this experience to some extent, that we hear things and they don't really sink in, and then later we maybe hear the same thing or we reflect on it later and it's like, oh wow, that says it so directly, or that's like really pointing to exactly the place where I'm stuck right now. And those are the turning words I need right now. So it's kind of like storing all this stuff in the storehouse consciousness for later or present use. And also, I also feel like Sesshin is the time, if any time, to really get into the really subtle and profound teachings. If we open to these practices, now is the time. Here's the place.
In my experience in Sesshin, when listening to lecture, and also listening to lecture outside of Sesshin, but with words that have been spoken will arise in my mind, and they will be beneficial.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So not necessarily something that I'm thinking about in the lecture.
Mm-hmm.
It will arise during meditation, and it will be a source of support for.
Yeah. Yeah, I think it can work that way. And also something about over and over again.
Yeah.
Because sometimes I feel like it's the same point in many different ways. Like, we have this whole year about the mirror, and it could have been like after the first teaching, okay, got that one. It's not that exciting to me, but like, you're going to talk for a whole year about mirror? It's like, there's not that much there, is there? But in my experience, hearing things from my teacher where he tends to get on a theme and go over and over to tedium and just like boredom. And then at some point, sometimes later, but sometimes on the, 50th time, it's like, oh, I see, thank you. It took 50 times of hearing the same thing, and Dogen says this too. Even if you feel like you kind of understand something, you have to hear it again and again and again for it to like sink deeper and deeper. And I And of course, I'm also trying to encourage myself. I wouldn't have any enthusiasm if this didn't mean anything to me. And so that's maybe the curse of listening to Dharma talks and stuff, is you get to, like, whoever the speaker is, it's like they're into something, and like you're subjective to what they're into. So you can either try to get through it, or just like, well, maybe, well, it's not my thing exactly, but let me see if what's here. Thank you for your helping to create these three different sesshins. Create, actually, two, and appreciate the third uncreated sesshin of mirror awareness. May this merit equally extend to every being and place, that all may realize Buddha's way. Beings are numberless. I vow to save them. Delusions are inexhaustible. I vow to end them. Dharma gates are boundless. I vow.